Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with
Catherine Kell,
who stars in the production of A Doll's House Part 2 by Roundhouse Theater, although it's down at the Lansbury Theater downtown during the renovations, but Oslo was great there, so I'm sure they're doing it again. And it's now through June 30th, so not much time. Get your tickets now, folks. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, did I hear that this is actually America's most produced play of the season? Is that true?
That's what I read. Certainly one of in the top five or the top tier. That is what I've read of the last season.
Wow.
Yeah. Wild,
that's
right?
Pretty crazy.
Yes,
why do you
everywhere.
Think that is?
Well, I mean, I think so. If you start, of course, it's a part two, right? Though you don't have to necessarily have read or have seen part one to enjoy this part, certainly. I do think the original source material, if you will, left such an impact on theater audiences for, you know, since it was written. And I think naturally, because this play deals with what has happened since that sort of final take or that final ending, I think people are really curious. I also happen to think that everyone who sees this play or hears about it or reads it is going to have, like, skin in the game. Do you know? Like, it's about relationships.
Right.
It's about...
It's not some topic you don't know anything about.
Yeah,
everybody relates to it.
There is no way to watch this story and not have an opinion or identify with someone. You don't have to be married. You don't have to be divorced. You don't have to be the child of somebody who's been divorced. And yet we all have ties to these types of relationships. And certainly, even if you don't have them yourself, you have opinions about them because they're such institutions in our culture, you know?
Right. Let's, since we're dealing with... something labeled a part two. Let's let's break them down one at a time because I want to hear your premise. You know, tell our listeners, you know, the premise and characters of this play. But first, before we even do that, remind them of what the original A Doll's House was. Norwegian play.
Right.
Henrik Ibsen.
So it's written by Henrik Ibsen, A Doll's House, and it focuses there's four characters in our play, and three of them feature largely in part one. I happen to play Emmy, who, though she is named and certainly a child in part one, she doesn't have any lines or have much to do.
Right.
So part one focuses on the marriage of Nora and Torvald, which on the outside is certainly a happy marriage. And throughout the play, certain events happen. And at the end of the play, Nora leaves Torvald with the slamming of a door.
At the end of the first one.
At the end of the first play. So that's really...
So it's like the reverse Godfather. She closes the door on it.
Yeah. So that's really...
Or Kramer versus Kramer. Pick your door closing reference.
Right, exactly. So I have found that that's really all you need to know in order to experience Doll's House Part 2, which is what we're doing.
And that was 1879?
Yeah.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
In Norway. Okay.
Yes.
Why do you think it took so long? Like, talk about that.
Two?
To do a sequel. Like, you know, a lot of times it's like, oh, we're going to do the Avengers sequel. That makes sense.
Yes.
But why, you know?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. Well, first of all, we're dealing with theater, right? So this is a part two. It's certainly not written by the same playwright. Lucas Naith wrote part
hope
two.
Not,
yeah, that
yeah,
would
agent,
you know,
a little agent. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Although that would be pretty impressive. but so because you're dealing, of course, with material that's, you know, not necessarily your own, though you might experience it. It's not like I guess there's something to be said for the way we experience sequels and stuff right now. They all seem a lot more close together.
Sure.
This is not that. It's my understanding that Lucas was very affected by Doll's House Part 1. That's not called Part 1, but that's what we have taken to calling it.
It's like World War One. They didn't call it World
War
One at the
time. They didn't call
it that.
They just called it, yeah, exactly. But that he was very affected by it, as a lot of theater practitioners are, and had kind of had an imaginative space around what happened to Nora after she left, and realized that a lot of other people had similar opinions, that if that's a standalone story and it ends with this woman leaving her marriage, leaving her children, which is something that wasn't done, and leaving it because for her own personal reasons,
right,
for other people who might have called the marriage happy or sufficient or fine.
Especially at the time. Yeah.
Especially at the time. It was such a massive shock for people that it really did reverberate through other literature, all the audiences over time. And I think maybe it sort of took until now for somebody like Lucas really to say, oh, what do we all think happened to Nora? And then investigate the answer to that question.
Right.
And it's my understanding that he found a lot of people thought that she had perished, thought that she had had a very difficult life, that maybe she had died, that whatever it was she left, because that she would have been, in a sense, punished by the world at large, because that was likely what could have happened. Mm-hmm. And he took that question and kind of ran with it. What if she didn't perish? What if, and what do, because I think when you ask people what you think happened to Nora, you're digging into their psyche a little bit, as is our play, which is, do you think that this woman could have thrived, that she could have survived, that she could have made it on her own? Or by the sheer virtue of the fact that she is a woman, would she have not been successful?
Right.
And I think people are really hungry for the answer to that question, and they're ready to kind of duke it out. You know, our play is also set. It's still set. It is, you know, there's questions of whether or not this is or is not a period piece. Our play is set 15 years after she leaves. So it's set, you know, in whatever 15 years after 1879 is.
Right. Close to turn of the century.
Right, exactly. So it's still, it's not of our time, 2019, and yet it has such a contemporary feel to it, too. That was a long-winded answer, Jason.
You say long-winded, I say more material for me to work with.
Wonderful,
so I like
great.
It. All right, so those are all of the, you know, questions that are teed up from the end of part one into part
right.
two.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the larger, you know, we're interested to see what happens after the door slams. But can you give us a little teaser of, like, this individually, like, what is sort of the premise here this time?
This
what is going
around,
on with these characters now?
Absolutely. So what I'll say is one of the reasons I think you don't necessarily need to have read part one, although, of course, it will make it more rich. I definitely think if you haven't experienced that, go back. You're probably going to want to go back after you see our show, you know?
But don't shy away. Get your tickets.
Yeah, get your ticket. Come on down to the theater.
You don't have to be familiar. It's self-contained stuff.
Exactly.
Okay.
The reason I think that is because to me, kind of the meat of this story is that it's a person coming back to face and own up to the consequences of a major massive decision that they made 15 years ago that reverberated and had an effect on everybody in their lives. And it's somebody coming back to talk about what some of those consequences are. And I think everybody can relate to that. You know,
right.
And I don't think it's necessarily going to be what you expect. I think there is quite a lot of, as we spoke about before, expectation about what happened to this woman, how she might feel when she's coming back, maybe why she's coming back, how other people will respond to her. You know, two of these characters. So there's Nora, who left at the end of the first play, mm-hmm. and she's come back. So that play ends with the slamming of a door. Our play begins with the knocking on a door.
Mm.
And she's come right back. Well, not right, 15 years. But she's come back to the same door. And
wow, this is a magical hallway.
Look at this time jump. It's science fiction. No, she comes back. She knocks on the door. And Anne-Marie, who also appears in the first play, answers the door. And then they have a conversation. Torvald eventually makes his way into the space. The husband who was left. And then him and Nora have a conversation. So far, all three of these characters were present in the first telling. They remember the events in a particular way. They have their own opinions about it. They also have their own opinions about what happened after she left.
This is the aftermath.
Right. So this is the aftermath. And then I play Emmy, who is her daughter, her only daughter.
You said she was mentioned in the
old
one, but
so
never
they,
appeared.
Right.
All grown up now.
Yeah. So depending on what version you see, there in some film versions too, there might be kids, but she's not a character that's played by an actress who is a fully fledged person. She's around four or five. She's very young.
So what's Emmy's place in this, or her journey in this?
What is your journey? Nora comes in. I'm also doing my best not to give away spoilers.
Sure, definitely
so,
don't.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. So Emmy comes in, you know, quite far into the telling of into our play. And she comes in because Nora still needs something. And they have a conversation. But Emmy, I find, because she was so young in the first play, she has two older brothers who are a little bit older, who remember her mother, but she does not. She remembers, I think, other people's opinions about her mother and what has been said about her mother.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't she didn't have a way to form her own opinions that first go around. So this is really the first meeting between those two women.
I see.
Which is just, you know, fodder for all kinds of all kinds of stuff. But really, it's a series of conversations with the woman who left, wherein each person gets to kind of have it out with Nora and vice versa. And they get to talk about the choices they made and the effect that had on other people, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Love it. Take me, let's go one by one through your, like, A-list co-stars here.
Oh,
because
gosh.
it's you know, titans of the local DC community,
yes.
You know, that you've seen them. And so let's start, you know, playing Nora is the great Holly Twyford.
Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing her at Ford's in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And
oh, yes.
She just
God.
Crushed it.
One of
my favorite shows in town I've ever seen. So, Holly, what makes her so great, especially in this particular role?
My goodness.
I can already see her doing it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so we'll go through each of them. But, I mean, I am so happy to be invited to this party. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, very happy to be invited. And I've been very excited for it for a long time. One of those reasons was Holly. I've seen her in a number of things. And I'm not from the DMV area. I'm originally from Northern California, but I've been out here for the last handful of years. I've worked in this town for a couple seasons. And one of the things I learned very quickly was that there was just a crop of fantastic, intelligent, talented, wonderful, wonderful actors, also wonderful humans, but wonderful actors. And that was one of the first things I ever learned was like, oh, this Holly Twyford seems to be in a lot. Oh, she's been here. Oh, people really know her work. She is really part of the fabric of this community. And having seen her also, I mean, yes, you speak about Virginia Woolf, seen her in a number of things where she is so smart and so authentic and dynamic and strong and charismatic and all the things you kind of want, you know, from a stage performer. I was very excited to find out that we were going to be working together. I was also, you know, certainly intimidated and, you know, didn't want to be the one who messes it up. But she couldn't be a more warm, funny, down-to-earth, just real great scene partner.
Right.
I think one of the things when you find yourself working with people that deserve their reputations, you know, it becomes your favorite thing to do. It becomes suddenly very, I wouldn't say easy, but because you're doing hard work, but it suddenly becomes very stimulating and it just feels like a wonderful gift to be able to kind of bat the ball with her a little bit. You know, and a lot of that is because of her sheer talent as an actor, but also just, you know, her warmth as a person. She's really about the work and is very invested in like having a discourse with everyone about the play and the characters in a very honest way, which I think produces really good work.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well said. Ex-husband Torvald. The great Craig Wallace, you know, took over for Ed Giro down in A Christmas Carol as Scrooge several years ago. I mean, we've seen him in productions all over town. But describe what makes Craig, you know, uniquely suited for this ex-husband role.
Oh, what a question. Well, Craig is – so out of this cast, Craig is the only person I'd worked with before. This is our third –
what'd you work in?
Well, this is our third production. Although I wouldn't say that we necessarily worked together, even though we've been in three productions, because as we would say, we kind of tap out.
Right.
Like in our first play, we did it was formerly called The Guard at Ford's. It's now called The Rembrandt. It's since been renamed. And I was in the first part of that show, also a small cast, and then he was in the second part. So we would just hang out backstage, and then I would finish my part of the play, and then he would go take over. I was also at a small part in Death of a Salesman, also at Ford's, which he did, I guess, two seasons ago, now if I'm getting my years right.
Yeah.
Which he was fantastic in. And we did make it to the same scene in that play, but I was Miss Forsyth, who appears in the bar.
Sure.
And he gave me quite a withering look before he left the stage. So that was that play. And now we get to be on stage for a couple more minutes, and we certainly have a relationship. Because he plays my father, and but we still don't get to have a real scene together yet, so I'm still waiting for that.
Right.
But I mean, to your question, why is he so suited for this role? I mean, I've so again seen him in a number of things, so talented, so smart, such a presence, such a force to behold on stage, that to see him also get to be cast as and investigate the lover, you know, the lover who was also left, the lover who maybe felt that he did all that he could, even if you have differing opinions, maybe he, you know, the character of Torvald, was certainly living one particular life and felt like it was a good life, and then had that imploded at the very end
of that. Ripped from the
root. Yeah, and then we don't hear any more from him, you know, like the door slams and the curtain, the lights go out, curtain goes down. So to have Craig Wallace bring Torvald now back to life, I think is a real gift for audiences. I think he really lends a lot of heart and soul to the part, and really, you know, because we don't have that much, you know, stage time together, I got to watch a lot of the rehearsal work, which was just a gift. But so to really watch him come at it with his whole heart, and to know that, you know, I think one of the real special things about this theater community is that, you know, him and Holly have worked together and known each other for years. So to watch him be able to draw on their kind of natural chemistry as friends and workers and comrades in this town, you know, was really just a wonderful thing to behold. And I think we're really lucky to have that in Torvald because, you know, he's the only man in the play, and it's really him and Nora that duke it out the most. Certainly she has a lot of time with Anne-Marie as well. But that first play is about a marriage that does not end well, you know? And so we want, I think we come to the story to watch the two people, the only two people who were in that previous marriage, and to watch them be together in space now. Yeah, and he just gives his whole heart and soul to it. So it's I feel like it's such a gift for us.
That's I mean, I love the guy. He's a great, he's been in a bunch. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
And then rounding it out, we Nancy Robinette as Anne-Marie.
Yes.
Dote on her.
Oh,
make her blush.
Well, one of the things, in addition to, so Nancy's also somebody I'd never worked with, but like Holly had seen in a number of things and was always just so taken with the life that she just creates on stage without saying a word, you know, when she starts speaking, it's even better, but just her sheer, she brings kind of everything into the space with her. A friend of mine that I was talking to the other day, I'll use his phrase, which he actually, I think, took from somebody we share a grad school in common, but to charge the space. So I'm stealing that, I believe, Malik Wilde. but
it's yours now.
But I really like, I really think that that's something that she does naturally. And so, and I think that's the thing that you always can't really name with like just great actors, but just you see them working. Maybe they've said words, maybe they haven't. It doesn't really matter what story they're in, but you go with them. You believe them. There is a whole life and a fully fledged person on stage. And that's how I feel about Nancy. Right. And everything that I've seen her in before, which was most recently The Heiress at Arena, which was just fantastic. And, you know, to then also be gifted rehearsal space with her, again, sitting around and watching other people work and talking backstage because we have a brief moment or two on stage, but we don't share any text. Though we do share a in-story relationship. You know, one of the things I've just loved is I've been so humbled by how she approaches her work with so much curiosity and empathy and patience in a way that she investigates all of the moments in the time that I think it kind of naturally takes, which is to say, you know, we rehearse this for a couple of weeks and you have the script beforehand, certainly, but the show keeps living. We keep discovering. We keep each night, you know, we learned stuff last night. We'll learn stuff tonight. And one of my favorite things has been that I get some offstage time with Nancy where we get to chit chat about how our scenes went and how did it feel for you, or, oh, I was listening.
Right.
And it's been a real lesson because, you know, to watch somebody whose work you admire, to see that they also carry some of the same sort of hang-ups that you do, where if you think something is really great, but somebody who's doing it maybe is like, oh, thanks for telling me, I didn't necessarily feel that way. is a real like, oh, it's right. very, it, of course it's different for the person in the driver's seat. Mm-hmm. I'm so, you know, in wonder of everything that you're doing, but of course you're working and you're discovering and you're trying things, and some things you think belong in the story and some things you don't think belong in the story. And right. to watch her continuously work her process is something I'm really learning from.
I love it. All right, so that's the four of you all.
Yes.
You know, the master talented actors. Who's corralling all of it? Nicole Watson. This is her first time directing for Roundhouse?
This is her first time, yes, directing in the company for Roundhouse. She's the associate artistic director, so she's been with them for their last season, right. but because we're the last play in this previous season, you know, she's not directing until right now. And I could not, I mean, you talk about, you know, the dynamic cast. I couldn't, like, be more lucky to have Nicole Watson at the helm of kind of all of us, and now, like, you know, have that as a like a valuable artistic experience, of which I have many, many, you know, hope to have many, many more.
Right.
She was such a great supporter and like a proponent of us investigating as deeply as we could. As she said one day, this play, you know, to decide what it is, to decide what our version of it is, like how we understand the text and how we understand how it works as a whole, we really have to go wide and we have to go deep and investigate any number of options, you know? And she was really there for that. And I think it was so stabilizing and grounding to have the person, you know, captaining the ship say, that's how I feel about it. And I'm watching you guys work, and it's okay that you're still discovering. That's what I think this play is. I think we're going to keep going through version A, version B, version C. Oh, we're going to go back to version A. Right. Oh, you know what? I think it's actually version Y.
Right.
Like,
right.
like to have somebody who's able to guide us through all of that, for me, was just made a world of difference because that's how I experienced my investigation of the character and the story. It was, it felt so... malleable in that way, you know, like it's not, as I've said before, it's not a play where, you know, you have to walk stage left and fall through the trap door so that somebody else can discover you. There's not, there's certain like emotional things we have to hit in terms of the text, like there's a place,
the emotional beats,
right, there's a place the story has to go to work. But beyond that, all of our movements, the way we live in the space, the way we interact with each other is tied to a very deep well of intention and like previous relationships that we have with each other as characters. So you really
need
to
that a little more. I mean, what do we, because we're the audience and we're radio, so paint a visual picture, if you will. But like, what do we see? Is it mostly that apartment? And how do you guys work that space blocking wise?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, Lucas, I think our set even had more than the Broadway version did. It's a room in the house, a room that is not really used that much anymore. In our version, what that means, it's at the Landsberg, of course, and there's quite a big room with empty frames, chairs, you know, pieces, a couple pieces of furniture that are no longer necessarily of daily use, but are kind of, you know, they've had their life, and maybe now they're in that room, that parlor that you don't go into that much. Or that you pass through. The idea being that it's really, you know, a space where ideas can really thrive, that it's not necessarily a place that's, though it's in Torvald and Emmy and Anne-Marie's home, it's not a place, at least the way, you know, I understand the set, is it's not a place that is, you know, all team Torvald, all team,
right.
You know, it's a place where Nora used to be. She remembers things being there, and they're no longer there. We get the sense that people do come through this space, but it is both different and the same in the way that when you come back someplace after being gone for many years, that can be. So it's a big room. We have a couple of chairs that get moved around as people feel the need to sit down or feel the need to pull up a chair next to somebody. There's a small chest, you know, to allow us another sitting space, but to come down, you know, it's very technical, to be able to break open the space so that we can come sit in a different part of the stage without blocking people.
Sure.
You sort of have to be, you have to have a lot of kind of real smart minds going at it, saying what do we need for the storytelling, what's appropriate for the time and the storytelling and what the playwright wants, and how do we also make it work, you know? Yeah. And it can be, for an actor, it can be a lot more scary when you don't have, like, a machine to hold on to,
sure.
You know? I found, as I said to somebody the other day, you know, I'd been so nervous for so long because you can't hide behind a big sword fight or a big, massive, you know, all the machinations of
right.
You know, a bunch of moving parts on the set. You're just coming out on stage and talking to each other, and you have some things that will support your intentions to do that. So yeah, I really welcome any of the feedback that we've had, which has been that it feels very natural, you know, which is I think good because mm-hmm. the people are there to talk to each other. You
right.
know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I have more than enough, but so I guess just in closing, if our listeners are listening to this, why should they come out? You know, some of them might hear, you know, oh, it's a Norwegian play from 1879. Is it a period piece? Do I got to be overly serious? But no, talk about how it's super contemporary, relevant, universal themes, and also quite funny.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that's one of the most fascinating, wonderful things about this show is I'm doing it, and I forget that it's not 2019 at times, because to me, the language is so visceral, and it's the way that people talk to each other, the way people talk to each other now, that makes it so relatable. You know, I think we have this idea that when stuff is a period piece or it's from another time, that we're gonna not be able to relate to it in terms of language. And many other things too, you know, whether that's style of dress or the way people behaved or social conventions, all those things, of course, are true. But, you know, this play really straddles the line between contemporary and 1879. It is both talking about conventions of that time and also talking about the way we feel about those conventions from a contemporary lens. And there are certainly phrases that feel deeply contemporary to us. And you have to wonder, did people say that to each other in 1879? Right. And the answer is like, possibly, yeah.
Yeah. Who cares? It makes it fun night in the theater.
Right. That's exactly, I think the reason it has such an impact is it's exactly what you want the characters to say.
Right.
It's anytime that anybody, I feel like, investigates a classical piece, inevitably what you sometimes find yourself doing is saying, oh, so he's basically saying this, right?
Right.
And this play it just tells you what she's saying.
They basically say it.
Yeah, they say their intention. They say what they really want and need to say and haven't been allowed to say for years.
Right.
And now is the time, because Nora has come back, that nobody's going to leave anything left unsaid.
Right.
And that I find produces a real impact, which is both funny and shocking. I feel like exhilarating. I definitely am so curious to hear how people respond to that aspect of it. I absolutely think that even if you never have seen a period piece and you claim that you don't like them, you could come see this play and you would be fine. You would be fine. I think you would enjoy it.
Awesome. Well, we hope everybody does. Again, it's called A Doll's House Part 2 by Roundhouse Theater. They always do great productions. And remember, this is down at the Landsberg Theater in the, you know, Chinatown Penn Quarter area, now through June 30th. So get your tickets now. Thanks so much for coming in. It was great meeting you.
Thank you for having me. Nice meeting you too.